Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
At six locations where the Indians attacked last night, unprovoked, the blatant aggression that they did, Pakistan has lost 26 civilians and 46 are injured.
Dozens of people have been killed in the worst fighting between India and Pakistan in more than two decades. Tensions between the nuclear-armed states soared after a deadly attack on Indian tourists in Kashmir last month. Now India has retaliated in both Kashmir and in Pakistan proper in the worst attack on Pakistan in half a century. Then, in a historic settlement, Columbia University and New York Presbyterian Hospital have agreed to pay $750 million to hundreds of women who were sexually abused by the former Columbia OBGYN, Dr. Robert Haddon. We'll speak with two of the survivors.
News of the settlement, $750 million, is monumental. It's a huge win for all survivors, Haddon survivors. It was a long, hard battle that we fought.
Then the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has found the U.S. border agents who fatally beat a Mexican father in 2010 responsible for torture. One of the agents accused of covering up the death of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas has now been nominated by President Trump to head the Customs and Border Protection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. India and Pakistan are exchanging heavy artillery fire across the line of control that divides Kashmir into Indian and Pakistan-administered areas. The cross-border fighting began after India launched a major military operation with a series of airstrikes on nine sites, including targets inside Pakistan. A Pakistani military spokesperson said the strikes killed at least 26 people and wounded dozens, including civilians. Among sites hit was a mosque in Pakistan's Punjab province. This is an eyewitness.
They hit the mosque directly, destroyed its courtyard, the minister's office in front of the mosque, and the roof. Everything was crushed. There was one person sitting on the roof on duty. He was martyred.
Meanwhile, Indian officials say at least 10 people have been killed and several wounded by Pakistani attacks on Indian-administered Kashmir. India's foreign minister called India's attacks a measured response to the massacre last month of 26 people in the Kashmiri resort town of Pahalgam, an attack India blamed on militants backed by Pakistan's government.
India exercised its right to respond and preempt, as well as deter more such cross-border attacks. These actions were measured, non-escalatory, proportionate, and responsible.
Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif called the Indian attacks an act of war. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has canceled an upcoming trip to Europe and is holding high-level cabinet meetings. Both India and Pakistan are armed with thermonuclear weapons. In a statement, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons warned, quote, a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan would cause millions of immediate deaths in the region and have global consequences, unquote. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed another 31 people, including 13 Palestinians who died when Israel bombed a school again east of Gaza City. A separate attack on a tent encampment for displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Balah killed three people, including a child. Amidst the unrelenting attacks, Hamas said it would no longer engage in ceasefire talks due to the catastrophic famine set off by Israel's total siege of Gaza, now in its ninth week. A spokesperson for the United Nations Aid Coordination Office said Israel's unlawfully weaponized food, water, fuel, and medicine.
Aid should be provided based on humanitarian need to whomever needs it, targeting those who need it most first, and not be used as in any way as a tactic to move people to any particular place or to convince people to do this, that, or the other. It is to cover their basic life-saving needs. Punto.
Israel's military bombed the main airport in Yemen's capital Sana'a on Tuesday, an attack that set passenger jets on fire and disabled the airfield. Yemen's Houthi movement says the bombing left three people dead. Elsewhere, witnesses reported at least four other Israeli strikes across the capital region. The Israeli attacks came as President Trump said the U.S. would no longer launch attacks on Yemen, after the Houthis reportedly reached out and expressed that they, quote, don't want to fight anymore, unquote. A top Houthi negotiator later said the U.S. ceasefire did not apply to Houthi operations against Israel. In Ukraine, a Russian missile attack on the city of Sumy on Tuesday killed three people, including a child. At least 10 others were wounded in the attack, most of them children. The strike came as Ukraine launched a third consecutive night of drone attacks on Moscow, a barrage that came as foreign leaders, including China's Xi Jinping, are heading to Moscow for a Victory Day parade commemorating the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany. In related news, The Washington Post reports the Trump administration's urged the Ukrainian government to accept an unspecified number of U.S. deportees who are citizens of other countries. Even though Ukraine lacks functioning airports to receive deportation flights due to constant Russian attacks, this follows reports the Trump administration's offering cash payments or political concessions to several African nations to accept deportees from the United States. The U.S. Senate's confirmed Frank Bisignano as Social Security Commissioner, an appointment labor leaders warn could lead to the destruction of Social Security. He's a banking executive with a net worth estimated at nearly $1 billion. In March, he declared, "I am fundamentally a DOGE person," referring to Elon Musk's efforts to gut federal agencies. He was confirmed Tuesday on a party-line vote, 53-47. Among those voting no is Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Frank Bisignano will rubber-stamp Trump and Musk's attack on Social Security. He'll let them keep slashing services. He'll let them keep threatening benefits. And that's going to hurt people everywhere, from seniors who count on their monthly checks right now, to the parents of kids with a disability supported by Social Security, to every American who is paying into the program now, for results later on down the line.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday temporarily allowed the Trump administration's ban on transgender military members to take effect. The measure will be enforced while legal challenges are resolved. In response to a slew of anti-trans executive orders signed by Trump, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in February ordered an immediate ban on transgender military recruits and halted all gender-affirming medical procedures for active-duty military. Hegseth also issued a policy giving the military 30 days to identify trans service members and remove them from their positions. In response to the Supreme Court's decision, Hegseth said on social media, quote, "No more trans at DOD, no more dudes dressed in dresses. We're done with that." He used the S word, which rhymes with hit, Hegseth said, using the expletive. In immigration news, a federal appeals court in Boston has rejected the Trump administration's attempt to revoke temporary deportation relief for an estimated 400,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela living in the U.S. under a two-year parole protection granted to them by President Biden. In related news, two federal judges Tuesday blocked the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to expel Venezuelan immigrants without due process. U.S. District Court Judge Alvin Hellerstein's ruling halts the removal of immigrants under his court's jurisdiction in New York, while a preliminary injunction issued by U.S. District Judge Charlotte Sweeney bars Trump officials from removing Venezuelans detained in Colorado. These are the latest legal defeats against Trump's mass deportation plans, coming after a Trump-appointed judge in Texas issued a permanent ruling against Trump's use of the 1798 wartime law, rejecting Trump's claim of an invasion by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua to justify the expulsions. Meanwhile, a newly declassified memo shows U.S. intelligence agencies privately rejected Trump's claim that the Venezuelan government directs Tren de Aragua, a claim that was key to Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. This all comes as more details have emerged in the case of another Venezuelan man who was illegally sent to El Salvador's maximum security mega prison in March. Trump officials removed 20-year-old Daniel Lozano Camargo from the U.S. in violation of a 2024 legal settlement that prohibited immigration authorities from deporting him while his asylum application is pending. Lozano Camargo came to the U.S. from Venezuela as an unaccompanied child last month. A federal judge in Maryland ordered his return. In El Salvador, the government of President Nayib Bukele is reportedly preparing to issue arrest warrants for several journalists working at the acclaimed Central American independent outlet El Faro. In its announcement, El Faro said a reliable source with close government knowledge contacted the outlet staff, issuing the warning, which came after El Faro published an interview with two former gang leaders who revealed new details on a power-sharing agreement with Bukele and his years-long complicity with gangs. In a statement Monday, El Faro said, quote, if carried out, the warrants are the first time in decades that prosecutors seek to press charges against individual journalists for their journalistic labors, unquote. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney met with President Trump at the Oval Office Tuesday, where he rejected Trump's call to annex Canada as the 51st state.
Having met with the owners of Canada over the course of the campaign last several months, it's not for sale, won't be for sale ever.
In response to Carney's remarks, Trump said, quote, never say never. While Prime Minister Carney mouthed the words never, 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 Trump also said during Tuesday's Oval Office meeting that nothing Carney could say would persuade him to lift U.S. tariffs on Canada. In Florida, the family of 23-year-old Roger Fortson, an Air Force member killed by a sheriff's deputy inside his own home last year, have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit. The suit alleges Deputy Eddie Duran used excessive and unconstitutional deadly force when he shot Fortson just seconds after he answered the door of his own apartment. Fortson's family said police arrived at the wrong home and that Fortson grabbed his legal firearm as a precaution. Police body cam footage showed Fortson answering the door with his gun at his side, not posing an imminent threat to the officer, who immediately shot Fortson six times. Fortson's family is being represented by the civil rights attorney, Ben Crump. And in Tennessee, jurors on Tuesday began deliberating in the trial of three former Memphis police officers charged with murdering Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who died after the officers brutally beat him during a traffic stop in January of 2023. Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith were convicted on federal charges last year. State prosecutor Tanisha Johnson was the last attorney to speak to the jury on Tuesday before deliberations.
If you follow the facts in the law, your mind can rest easy that there sits three men who are criminally responsible for the murder, the aggravated kidnapping, and the aggravated assault of Tyree Nichols, as well as official misconduct and official oppression. Find them all guilty as charged of every charge.
Two other former Memphis police officers involved, Desmond Mills Jr. and Emmett Martin, have pleaded guilty to state charges and are not standing trial. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Dozens of people have been killed in the worst fighting between India and Pakistan in more than two decades, following a deadly attack last month on Indian tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. Early today, India attacked nine locations in Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir, killing at least 26 people, including a child. Dozens were wounded. Pakistan called the attacks an act of war and responded by shelling areas of Kashmir under Indian control. India says the Pakistani shelling has killed at least 15 people. Pakistan claims to have shot down at least two Indian fighter jets. Tensions have been soaring between the two nuclear-armed nations since April 22nd, when gunmen massacred 26 tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir in a rampage that India blamed on Pakistan. For now, we go to London, where we're joined by Mirza Wahid, award-winning Kashmiri journalist and novelist. His books include The Collaborator, The Book of Gold Leaves, and most recently, Tell Her Everything. His recent Guardian piece is headlined, A Massacre Has Reignited the Forever War Between India and Pakistan. Once more, Kashmiri voices are missing. Well, they're not missing here, Mirza Wahid. So if you can start off by talking about what's at stake right now and give us the progression of what took place. First, the attack on Indian tourists in Indian-administered Pakistan and India-administered Kashmir and what that means.
Thank you for having me. Those killings were reprehensible, and it was a massacre of Indian tourists in a pristine, really idyllic meadow in Pahalgam, where I lived as a child. And it's a very gorgeous and beautiful place. And those killings were shocking, obviously, and condemnable, reprehensible. And that is the main trigger for this, you know, recent escalation now. Because soon after the killings, there was obviously outrage in India, in the public, in the media, across the society and the political classes. And we very soon we heard big clamors for war, clamor for war, especially in the media. So a lot of pressure to strike on targets in Pakistan, and it was kind of, we knew it was happening. Obviously, one hoped it shouldn't happen, it wouldn't happen, but that's what's happened now. And in many ways, Amy, this is an old war. This is a very, very old war, and not as old as the American president believes it to be, not centuries old, but about 75 years old. My grandfather saw the first India-Pakistan war in 1948. My father saw the wars in 1965 and 1971, and then in 1999, the limited war over Kargil. And I have seen 1999 and now this recent, the latest escalation. This is a dangerous escalation. It's a dangerous intensification because, as your preview said, people have been killed on both sides of the border, almost all of them civilians. That has to be emphasized and noted, that people who've been killed in the shelling are all civilians. And as we speak, in the borderlands between Indian and Pakistani administered Kashmir, people are hiding in makeshift bunkers, in underground shelters. Some of them are kind of contemplating leaving. The main airport in Kashmir is sealed off, as other airports in some parts of northern India. There's a huge amount of fear in the public, and this is that old thing, isn't it? When elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled upon. So Kashmiris have been kind of in the middle for a long, long time now, and it fills me with despair as a Kashmiri person, as a writer, as someone who's kind of thought about it and written about it. It fills me with a lot of despair, and I'm upset about the killings in Pahalgam, about the subsequent clampdown in Kashmir, where thousands of people were arrested, houses of families who are linked to Kashmiri militants demolished, and now these strikes and the counter-offensive from Pakistan. So I'm really, really upset, and I didn't sleep last night because you were worried. We didn't know what we were going to see in the morning.
And Mr. Waheed, you've mentioned that this has a long history, that there have been numerous conflicts in past decades. But at the heart of it, why has it been so difficult to resolve, and why have the Kashmiris fallen under both a Pakistan-administered territory and India-administered territory?
I'm going to try and give a basic sort of primer on history. So we go back to the partition. India and Pakistan become modern nation states. Kashmir is left unresolved. Soon they begin their first war over Kashmir in 1948, which is then brought to an end through UN mediation. There's a ceasefire. In fact, it's an interesting thing I must note. The line of control that divides two parts of Kashmir right now was actually called a ceasefire line, a CFL, which came into existence soon after the first war I mentioned in 1948. And then it was formalized and renamed as line of control in 1972 after India-Pakistan fought another war, which resulted in the creation of Bangladesh. So they have fought these wars. And it's very clear. I mean, they have fought over Kashmir historically, all my life and my father's life. And there's three generations of Kashmiris and Indians and Pakistanis who have kind of, you know, grown old under this threat of war. It kind of, there's relative periods of peace between the two countries, and then something will bring about a fresh escalation, right? As the attacks in Pahalgam have done, they haven't been able to solve Kashmir. India kind of has in recent years claimed that it's kind of brought Kashmir to normalcy, but this doesn't look like normalcy to me. There's the fighter planes. Pakistan claims it's kind of brought down fighter planes. India has hit. This is also unprecedented because India has hit targets inside Pakistan. In previous escalations, previous conflicts, they would hit targets inside Indian Pakistan and also Kashmir, all of Kashmir, being a disputed territory. But this time, they have gone into targets inside Punjab, inside interior Pakistan, which is what I cited as a very, very dangerous intensification.
And how has the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi affected relations between Pakistan and India, his increasingly nationalist stand in India?
Yes, it is a different regime than previous regimes. They are more open to armed response, which we have seen. And they believe, and they say they had a presser where they said that they have responded in retaliation to the attack in Pahalgam, as they did in 2019 when there was an attack on an Indian paramilitary convoy in Kashmir, in South Kashmir, in which about more than 40 Indian paramilitary troopers were killed, and then there was a strike in Balakot, which is in Pakistan, administered Kashmir. But this time, they have kind of gone inside Pakistan. The Indian government claims that they have resolved Kashmir, by which I mean in 2019, they revoked Kashmir's limited autonomy under the law, under Indian dominion, and said now tourists are coming, it's returned to normalcy, the economy is looking up, and Kashmir is normal. But it is not normal, because what happens is, you see, you can't impose solutions. You can impose order. You can impose law and order. You can't impose peace. And it's clear that this is imposed peace, and it's now blown wide apart. And I really, really worry. And until they solve Kashmir, my worry is that it's going to come back to haunt the two countries again and again. And nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. Least of all, the Kashmiri people. They're tired. They are tired of the enormous, enormous suffering they have seen over the last 30, 40 years. Thousands and thousands of killed. Kashmiris have been killed. And people in India and Pakistan, they have been killed. And it's in nobody's, interest for this conflict to continue to claim lives like this. And You know, I was thinking earlier that I really miss the old days when, you know, when people used to be opposed to war and warmongering. But now I also want to point out that we're now at a point in history where, you see, back in the day, we used to look up to the United States and Britain and Europe, and because phone calls would be expected to be made to the leadership in India and Pakistan, urging restraint, urging people, calmer minds to prevail, and so on and so forth. But now that order is collapsed, post Gaza, it is collapsed. I don't think the Americans and the Brits have the same legitimacy. I mean, not that they had much back in the day, but, you know, there was at least the semblance of this expectation that, you know, phone calls would be made from London and Washington to urge restraint. But I don't think they have the same legitimacy and same influence,
Mirza,
as they have.
We just have 30 seconds. These are two nuclear-armed nations. The final comment on the significance of this.
Solve Kashmir. The two countries have to solve Kashmir. Otherwise, they'll keep they'll stay engaged in this forever war.
Mirza Wahid, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Journalist and award-winning Kashmiri novelist. We'll link to your recent piece, A Massacre Has Reignited the Forever War Between India and Pakistan. Once more, Kashmiri voices are missing. When we come back, a historic settlement. Columbia University and New York Presbyterian Hospital have agreed to pay $750 million to hundreds of women who are sexually abused by the former Columbia OBGYN Robert Haddon, while Columbia ignored his patients who spoke out, undermined prosecutors, and shielded the sexual predator. We'll speak to two survivors and the lawyer who accomplished this settlement. Back in 30 seconds.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river. And the whole world sings. Sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow.
Body Electric by Alinda Segata of Hooray for the Riffraff in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York, an historic settlement is being hailed as a landmark victory for hundreds of women who survived abuse by the former Columbia University gynecologist Dr. Robert Haddon for over 20 years, while Columbia ignored his patients who spoke out, undermined prosecutors, shielded the sexual predator. On Monday, a Manhattan judge approved the settlement in which Columbia University and New York Presbyterian agreed to pay $750 million after the former doctor abused the women under the guise of medical examinations, legal payouts, and now top more than $1 billion following earlier settlements. Altogether, it's the largest in U.S. history with a medical institution. Dr. Haddon was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2023 for molesting his patients. Columbia University said in a statement to the Associated Press Tuesday, the settlement was, quote, another step forward in our ongoing work and commitment to repair harm and support survivors, and said it's, quote, implementing a multi-pronged plan, including an external investigation, a survivor settlement fund, and a series of new and updated patient safety policies and programs to address the abuses of Robert Haddon. For more, we're joined by two women who sued after surviving Haddon's abuse. Lori Maldonado, Lori Maldonado is with us. She was an OBGYN patient of Haddon's between 2003 and 2012. Eva Santos Velos was just 18 years old when Haddon was assisting in an emergency delivery and she says, sexually abused her. We're also joined by their attorney, Anthony DiPietro, who's representing hundreds of sexual abuse claims by former patients of Robert Haddon. We welcome you all to Democracy Now. Lori, let's begin with you. It has been years now, but this is an enormous accomplishment, not just the money settlement, but the laws you all